In this episode of The Ziglar Show, we hear from a world-renowned health and fitness expert. She's the picture of health and beauty and success. Then she found herself up on stage to speak to a room full of addicts who she was critically judging for who and how they were. Then she realized they were judging her as well. And then she realized she needed to drop the facade, come clean, and admit she had come from where they were, maybe even worse. Today, Tana Amen is vice president of the renowned Amen Clinics, and still every bit the picture of health and beauty, even more, but now an even greater level of success because her gritty story makes that success so far more glorious. If you've had anything less than a perfect, shiny life, you're going to gain so much from Tana's message. If you're intrigued by the discussion you hear, I encourage you to check out her new book. It's The Relentless Courage of a Scared Child, How Persistent Grit and Faith Created a Reluctant Healer. I read it. Now my wife is reading it. It's just a powerful journey of someone who had every reason to fail and overcame it. But as you're going to hear, she made a different choice. You can also find more from her at relentlesscourage.com, and I'm going to bring her to you in just a moment. Hi, everyone. I'm Kevin Miller. I'm so privileged to host three podcasts that have now surpassed 50 million downloads. They're all for people who want to truly grow and change and find fulfillment and joy in their lives. This podcast is The Ziglar Show, and where we focus on professional development, succeeding in your career and business. Here I talk with people who have had great professional success doing something they truly care about that serves others. We also take professional and personal development questions to the audience, and Tom Ziglar and I come together to have a conversation around those responses every week. I encourage you to visit ziglar.com/podcast and join Tom Ziglar and the family of Ziglar for the inspiration we all need. And right now he's inviting you to join him to become a Ziglar coach. Again, go to ziglar.com/podcast or email him at tomziglar@ziglar.com. In my motive podcast, we get to the root of our desires, our reasons. Our motives fuel everything we do, yet we're generally unaware of them. In the latest episode, 21, I bring you, I think, my most epic story of motive so far. And it comes from Jared Ongaza, who takes us from the Nashville music scene to dealing with sex slavery in Africa for a decade and now into space, literally. What drives a guy to go where he has? As is so often the case here, as I press for the core motives of my guests, Jared discovered further insight into himself and followed our time by stating a realization that he said, I like to hurl myself into the unknown, into something that will challenge and stretch me. Every chance I get, it pulls the magic out of me and connects me more deeply to everyone and everything around me. In the True Life podcast, we address our health and wellness. You are the vehicle for all you do. And if your body and mind are compromised, so are all of your efforts. In the latest episode, number 64, we talk with Dr. Dan O'Neill about the plight of our kids who are getting fatter and sicker and less smart as a result. What it means for them, what it means for the present and increasing healthcare crisis, it's dramatic. And of course, then we talk about what can we do about it. You can find all three shows in Apple Podcasts. Just search for Kevin Miller. Or go to my website, kevinmiller.co. I'm a foodie and I enjoy learning about the process that brings great foods and beverages from idea to the table. And then I like tasting them and learning the nuances of what creates the most significant tastes from coffee to cheese to distilled beverages. I did a tequila tasting in Mexico and recently bourbon. Heaven Hill Bottled in Bond Bourbon really impressed me from the story to the taste. I grew up in Kentucky where horse racing and bourbon are famous, and I got introduced to Heaven Hill Bottled in Bond Bourbon. It's produced by Heaven Hill Distillery, which has been and still remains family-owned since 1935, and I'm impressed with the bourbon's ultra-rich, smooth taste, and right on the bottle it states that this bourbon is 7 years old, which is actually three times longer than what's required to be certified as bottled in bond. I feel with beverages, the longer the prep, the better the taste. Being a bottled in bond product means it must pass a list of 7 requirements that set the standard for this quality bourbon. So look for it at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely and drink wisely.
Well, Tana, I've known of you and your husband, Daniel. I've known of you guys for a long time and intended to have you on a show talking about, you know, health and wellness and brain and all that kind of good stuff. And then when I got contacted by your publicist and got this book, I assumed that that's what we were looking at. and it was quite not what I thought it would be. And I'm wondering if you're getting that a little bit of surprise from people like this is, weren't expecting this from you.
Yeah. I'm getting that a lot.
I imagine. And I also then thought, you know, I saw you, I was kind of just doing my research on you and saw you on some of the 700 Club and some of the faith-based organizations. And I thought, yeah, the book's fairly raw. And
It's very raw. It's very gritty.
And I wondered, have you had some of the, I'm just going to couch it in the faith-based communities, had some folks there go, ooh, I'm not sure that's a little bit much for our crew?
Shockingly, no. And
really?
That's what surprised me. I only had one that was worried about losing sponsors, one radio show that was worried about, and they still had me on. They decided to just ask me bluntly why I decided to be so real and so raw and not make it a softer message.
Yeah.
And the truth is, I actually intentionally, when I decided to write the book, it took me a long time to decide to write this book. Because when you write about health and wellness and someone criticizes it, oh, well, not a big deal. But when you write about the hardest things in your life and people, you know that they're going to criticize it. You just have to know that when you write anything these days. But that's something you brace yourself for. But I made the decision that if I'm going to go through that and I'm going to be criticized, which I am, what's my goal? My goal is to help people understand they're not alone if they've been through a similar situation. And the only way I can do that is to be super honest, to be really raw, really real about what it was like. Because otherwise, the people who are going through that now or have been through it and haven't released the shame and the pain are going to say, well, so what? It wasn't as bad as what I went through.
Right.
So when I decided to write this book, I actually made the specific and intentional decision I would not write it as a faith-based book. I would not make it a Christian book or a spiritual book because I wanted to be super honest. But the crazy thing is, I mean, God works in such mysterious ways. God had a different idea. Two things happened. Number one, that was the publisher that went, Thomas Nelson was the publisher that went crazy over it. They loved it. I told them, I go, you know, I'm not going to change this messaging, right?
I was literally going to ask. It was part of my question because I know Thomas Nelson. I know those guys over there and I've been involved with Michael Hyatt for many years. And I thought, did you get any pushback from them? And you're saying no, it sounds like.
So what happened was my editor really fought for me. She said, look, she goes, we don't want any gratuitous language or gratuitous information in there. But if it's your story of overcoming and it's what you went through, then yes, we want it in there. What we're going to do is we're going to do a focus group. They actually had a focus group of 200 people go through it. And so they're like, they decided the language actually had to be in there in order to tell the story because it paints the picture of the environment that I grew up in. But what they did is they're like, let's figure out how to deliver it. What's the delivery going to be? And so that's what we really focused on was how do we deliver it without intentionally alienating the faith-based community, but still telling the truth?
Yeah.
Because let's face it, the Bible is full of awful stories, icky stories, you know, messy stories. Our lives are messy. They're real. And that's what I wanted to deliver. So two things happened. Thomas Nelson was the one who fought for this book. And I was trying to figure out, do I want to put a lot of faith in there? Because how do you mix the ugliness of what I grew up with then delivering any kind of faith message in the book? It sort of feels awkward.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help it. It just came out. That's what came out. And as I prayed about it, I'm like, you know, God, you're just going to have to take this because this was my life. It was messy. It was ugly. It was painful. And it was my faith that sort of pulled me through it.
Well, and I appreciate you saying that even in the Bible, you know, the stories there, I mean, we have really watered down so many of those. It was in one of Donald Miller's books that he brought that to my attention. He says, yeah, why do we take babies' rooms, which we had with some of our kids, and put Noah's Ark all over them? He says that the real story was babies drowning and getting their heads bashed against rocks, and yet we've taken it and watered it down. So now I will say, I want to tell people, because we do have a fairly conservative audience here on The Ziegler Show, that when you talk about language, I mean, you've got it, you know, it's like bleeped out, with the little symbols, but it's real to the story. Well, so you're not the first person, Tana, that I've had on the show and that's been on lots of shows and written books. It's forged success from a hard upbringing, defying it or overcoming it and harnessing it as their personal brand. But what intrigued me about your story right off the bat, you talk about that in the first story, you talk about going to the prison, I think. And that it sounds like, I'm going to ask you, did you to a point, omit it. So yeah, you're this health and wellness professional and superstar over here. Did you purposely omit that story or even try to hide it? Or did it just feel like it wasn't relevant to what you were doing?
So my past story was, that was the first time it really came out.
Okay.
So that, and it was spontaneous. It was a God thing.
Oh, I love the story. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a God thing. So I was very judgmental. I was actually at one of the largest chemical addiction recovery programs in the country where most of the people were criminals and court ordered to be there. And so, and I was very judgmental. In fact, I didn't realize how judgmental I still was until I showed up there. Didn't want to be there. I even told my husband, I was crying and I'm like, God picked the wrong person this time.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this. I don't have empathy and compassion for these people because of the pain I had experienced in my childhood with my uncle being a heroin addict, my other uncle being murdered in a drug deal gone wrong. There was just so much stuff in my past. And I didn't realize just how judgmental I still was. But when I showed up there and I've got all these awful thoughts in my head about what I think of these people, I'm labeling them addicts, junkies, you know, criminals, like all these thoughts are in my head. And I'm thinking, but I'm also intelligent and I'm educated and I'm a nurse. And I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, how am I going to reach these people? And so I said a prayer. I always pray before I go on stage. I was saying this prayer, this quick prayer. And I'm like, please just let, you know, one person, if they need to hear something, hear it, but it's going to have to come from you, God, because I just am not up to this today.
Yeah.
And it was so interesting. I had an epiphany as I was on stage. For the first time ever, I looked out and all of a sudden it struck me. I'm like, I'm seeing them as criminals. I'm seeing them as addicts, as junkies. And they were judging me just as harshly. You know, one lady raised her hand and she's like, what do you know about my life? Look at you. Your life is perfect. And she was seeing what I wanted her to see. She was seeing this facade that I had created, you know, made with hair and makeup and clothes and to keep people out. And so that was to keep people from seeing the pain from the past. And so it kept distance. And when she said that, I realized, you know, we're just sitting here judging each other. And for the first time, I looked out and I could see scared children like I was when I was growing up, scared children that grew up in those environments where, you know, people were murdered, where drug deals went wrong, where people were molested, where kids nearly drowned. I mean, those are my early memories.
Yeah.
And that's, I'm going to get choked up. So God answered that prayer.
Yeah.
I saw scared children just like me. And so I stepped back and it was the first time I told the story. I went off script and I'm like, you know, how many of you are judging me?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So they didn't raise their hand at first. I'm like, well, I'm judging you. And so then they got defiant and they were raising their hands. And I said, I'm going to tell you a story. It's a story about a scared little girl. And then I went into my childhood. And by the end of it, there were tears and we were hugging. And I spent 2 years with those people. And it became one of the most fulfilling, rewarding things I've done. It was incredible.
Well, and so is that your, I'm always curious with somebody who authors a book like yours, especially in a memoir scenario, are they somewhat your target, your muse to write to? Was there anybody specifically that you had in mind? You know, that as a, I'm writing a book right now as well. And, you know, they school us to write to that person, speak to that person who you want to really resonate with. Who was it?
So I think there's two audiences. One are people who grew up with trauma.
Yeah.
And I hated the word trauma. I still don't love the word trauma because it makes me feel like a victim. But there's a difference between being victimized and living as a victim.
Yeah.
And so, but when you grow up in trauma, it just means that some event happened or events happened that made you feel like your world was unsafe and you couldn't trust the people around you. That's really what it means. So people who grew up in trauma who are trying to overcome it, who just can't sort of let the shame go. We tend to blame ourselves.
Okay.
And, or both, people who are having trouble letting go and forgiving and don't want to reconnect with family that they know they should or need to help. And they're just struggling with that. Like I disconnected from all of my family and there's so much healing that comes with forgiveness. And that's a hard thing to do. So those are my two audiences. It's like, when do you get back involved? When do you help? When do you need to keep hard boundaries? And so those are the two audiences. And interestingly enough, I think that the group with the addiction,
yeah,
they fit both of them. People who are actively in addiction are not going to read my book. They're not ready. But it's the people recovering. It's the people who have struggled. Maybe they chose that route, that road, because they haven't dealt with their demons yet. They haven't healed from the past.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that, how long ago was that?
That was 2010.
2010. Okay.
Yeah. Well, in 2011.
I mean, you had achieved, I'm interested in a couple of things. You had achieved some successes in your life at that point with this being, you know, in the background. Is there a, and I really stumble with using the word regret because it has such negative baggage, but just a, I wish I had done this sooner.
Oh, geez. You want the list? We don't have time in this podcast.
Well, in saying, I wish that I had come forth with this message. I had divulged this stuff. I had made it part of my story before then. So is that it?
I don't know about that. I feel like this message came out right when it was supposed
okay.
to.
Okay.
But I thought you meant, had I made decisions before that I wish I had.
Well, you showcase that in the book. Oh, so, yeah. So well, well, because my curiosity as you're writing this is we have so many people out there. I mean, this is an aspiring audience. That's how I refer to them all the time. They're not here listening to, you know, NPR's crime scene or whatever, just for entertainment. They're here to learn and to grow. So okay. By proxy, we can give folks that. In that, do you feel, and you said something to this point, or I extrapolated it from that a minute ago, giving people permission to tell their story. Would you say that if you have this story behind you, would you even advocate, don't hide it, let it be part of your story, even from a business standpoint, your brand and who you are, the personality that you are?
100%. But I do think people need to be ready.
Okay.
There's a lot of reasons. You know, I have a little girl. This book is raw. Now she's going off to college. So now she's ready. But I needed to make sure that I could talk to her, really, you know that she understood some of what I went through in my past, some of that pain that I had been through, and why and what it meant. Also, I needed to know that I had dealt with my demons before you try to put it all out there. And vulnerability, there's so much power in vulnerability. But if you're not ready and you haven't dealt with it, there's also a lot of criticism that comes along with putting your story out there. So you do need to know that you are strong enough and that you've dealt with this enough. So it came out at the perfect time. And I feel like God's timing is always right. I really do. Okay. After going through enough of what I've been through, I've often questioned him. I've often argued with him, fought with him, but he was always right. So...
Okay. A moment ago, when you're telling a bit of the story about being in front of this audience of addicts, you said, you know, they're judging you. Here you are judging them, but they're judging you. And here's this facade. Use that word. It's a curious word because it feels like you could also say it's a fruition. How do you balance that? Did you look at it at that point as a facade? Because I mean, I'm looking at you now and you look well. you look like things are going well. I don't think that that's a facade now. I would say it's a fruition, but how is that changed in the past decade?
Yes, it has.
Okay.
So there was a time where I didn't want people close to me. So I built walls, and I thought I suffered with an eating disorder for a long time. Yeah. I started in my teens because I was struggling for some control over the craziness in my life. And so there was so much brokenness inside and blame. Like I blamed myself and there's a lot of shame that goes along with what happened in my life. So I would try to cover that up and overcompensate with accomplishment. So if I'm fit enough, if I get good enough grades, if I can succeed enough, if I can overcome these things, people won't know.
Yeah.
But I can't let people really know me, because if they knew the truth, they wouldn't love me. So there was this crazy fight going on inside of me. Now it's very different. Now it's more, I do this because I choose to, because it's work. It's my job, but I don't live my life like this. Like I wouldn't leave my house without looking perfectly made up. And, you know, now if I gain weight or, you know, a few pounds or my makeup's not on or whatever happens, it's just part of life. That's my everyday life. It's not something I need. It's not my crutch or my wall.
You are listening to The Ziegler Show and this episode with Tana Amen and her profound story of success and then true redemption. Again, you can find her and her new book at relentlesscourage.com. Here are some great resources for you. Then we're going to jump right back in. Friends, I'm pretty candid about my lack of financial prowess. Money and numbers are fairly Greek to me, so I need a lot of guidance. One of my closest friends is a wildly successful wealth manager, and I'm working on some financial literacy and just continually seeking guidance. So I ask you to check out yahoofinance.com. Nobody Knows It All on Yahoo Finance is an incredible resource for the rookies like me or the seasoned investors. You know, before my dad passed away recently, Dave Ramsey and his wife Sharon flew down to visit. We all got to spend a day together, and I was at YahooFinance.com just now. I saw multiple news flashes from Dave and other people that you respect, and they're hitting so many of the hottest areas in finance today. So it's a place to get a snapshot of all aspects of your financial interests, and if you have them, your portfolios. I hadn't realized Yahoo Finance is the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. So for your comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. One more time. YahooFinance.com. When we fast, we stop eating food and allow our body to repair. The research on the benefits and the reset is profound. The problem is we like food. We're addicted to food. Me too. Missing a meal or a day of eating is terrifying to a lot of people. So here is ProLawn. It's a revolutionary plant-based nutrition program that nourishes the body while making the cells believe they're fasting. ProLawn is not a diet, it's science based on Nobel Prize-winning discoveries in medicine. ProLawn provides a five-day program where you get snacks and soups and beverages all designed to keep your body in a fasting state while taking away the difficulty and mindset of deprivation. I've fasted for 5 days with nothing but water, and my physical and mental state was incredible. My struggle was just wanting to fulfill my habit of eating. It was significant. ProLawn took that away. It's amazing. I feel like I'm cheating, but getting the benefits of fasting. So right now, ProLawn is offering What Drives You listeners 10% off their five-day nutrition program. So go to ProLawnLife.com/Kevin. That's ProLawnLife.com/Kevin for the special offer. Thankfully, the days of building a business website, then having this massive endeavor to integrate an online store are gone. Today, Shopify has fixed all that. I had one business where we actually built the entire website on Shopify's platform. So whether you're just starting out or you're selling $1 million of product already, Shopify is just the industry leader. It works the same for physical products or online and digital, and Shopify is just hands down the best out there. Most importantly, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It's 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Getting people to buy is not that hard, at least to the buying point, but getting them to actually give their payment info is, and Shopify is king in that department. They also have top-tier customer service, which I think is critical. You can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Kevin. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Kevin to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Kevin.
In that aspect of the timing being right, as people are hearing this, because again, we're going to have tens of thousands of people hear this that have stories that if they do well to read your book, they've got stories that are, let's just call them trauma. They have trauma back there that is undealt with, has been hidden, that they may faultly think that they have gotten, you know, past, but in using it or in divulging it and letting it be a part of your story, even I'm again use the word even your brand, did you feel like when you said the timing's right for you, it's because you had achieved a level of health with it and confidence with it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's because several things had happened. I had found my faith. Yeah. And so that gave me a sense of strength. It's not all about me. And it was rocky. That was a rocky road for me, which I write about in the book. And then also I did the work on the trauma. So I overcame that trauma. I did that work. So I felt like I was ready. I felt strong enough. And I read my comments. When people write to me on social media, I read what they say. And so I know the different phases of the journey that they're in. And, you know, when people are just still so closed up, that shame is just binding them.
Yeah.
And I've been there. It's a hard place to be.
I'm going to speak just a little bit again to the business side. that folks are listening to, and that personal brand aspect. So you, this is a decade ago. Again, you achieved a lot of success then. You have a lot since that point. Have you seen, because you even mentioned the concern of, well, people think less of me. Mm-hmm. Have you seen your personal credibility, even as the brand of Tana Amen, increase as you have allowed this story to be brought forth?
Yeah, I was really nervous about it, and it ended up being the opposite of what I had expected. Okay. So people came closer. I think people felt like I was being more authentic by letting them in. Mm-hmm. And trust me, you're talking about the grittiness and the rawness of the book. It's the PG-13 version. Yeah. And I think anybody who's grown up in trauma can understand that. There's only so much you can write about people's lives, especially when they're alive. But when you're willing to put that into writing, yeah, there's going to be some criticism, but there was overwhelmingly more embracing than there was anything.
Well, yeah. I will admit I have had a privileged life. I have not gone through the trauma that you have. We have been privileged to walk with even some adopted kids who have come from some hard things. And so when you talk about XYZ that happened in the story, to understand the context of that, it's kind of like those biblical stories say, man, if that happened, there's a lot more horrific stuff that happened. So I want to, there's a few different veins I'm going to be going down here as we talk, because there's so much to go into. One here is, as I'm reading it too, as a parent, mm-hmm. it was hard not to be angered / hurt by what your mom allowed you to be exposed to. And yeah. You don't Pollyanna sugarcoat that, but you also never disparage her. And if anything, you talk about her in a positive light. And I was literally curious, just from the heart standpoint, because, you know, we can talk a lot about forgiveness and things like that. Was that a necessary part? Or did you authentically really always see her anyway, still in a positive light?
So my mom is still one of my best friends. I'm not going to say it was perfect, because it obviously wasn't. It's in the book.
Obviously, yeah.
But my mom is so interesting. So she's like this larger than life figure in my life and in the book. She was a 16-year-old runaway. So her life was so hard for her growing up, way worse than mine was. Her book would, you know, be much harsher than mine. So she was a 16-year-old runaway. She lived on the streets. She never finished high school. The woman was intense. I mean, intense to say the least. She worked three jobs to put food on the table, would not give up, never ever took government assistance because she didn't believe in it. So that was my example of a female growing up. It's like, I'm going to make it. You're going to go through the hard times with me. You're going to go through the good times with me. And I inherited her grit. So there's a lot of things about my family that I would like, you know, I wish I didn't have to go through, that I don't like, or that I didn't like. But there are a lot of things that I can appreciate as well. And that's one of them. But my mom, you know, she didn't have the education or the socioeconomic status or the upbringing to make really good decisions as a really young mom. And so I think she was doing the best she could, and she made some bad decisions. She definitely made some bad decisions. And you can kind of see that good decision, bad decision, good decision, bad decision. And so I think that's though a lot of times, you know, behavior is complicated. It's hard to, you know, it's easy to call people bad. It's harder to ask why. And so with my mom, it's just, I never doubted her love. And I think that's the difference between my mom and my dad, is I never doubted her love. She made so many bad decisions, but I never doubted her love for me.
Gosh, that's really telling. It makes me think of just the attachment issues that mm-hmm. I've learned about as a father that kids deal with, that I was so ignorant with, that she just, thank God, did some of those well with you. Because I again, you know, and I'm looking at it as a guy, as a father, I'm the protector, and to think the things that she allowed you to be exposed to, guys, men, that she brought in, it grieved me.
But we can either focus on, like I said, we can focus on how traumatized we've been. Yeah. And, you know, there's post-traumatic stress disorder, but there's also post-traumatic growth. Yeah. So I decided to take that experience from my past and go, okay, these are the things about my mom that I love. By the way, my mom, you want to talk about a success story. That woman who didn't have a high school diploma, still doesn't, never graduated from high school, retired an extremely wealthy woman.
Yeah.
So, and her faith is in, like, intense now. Now, I didn't grow up with that. Yeah. I didn't grow up with that model of church and God in my life, even though she always said she had faith. I didn't know what that meant. But she's a very, very successful woman now.
Yeah.
So she's intense. But I decided to take that and say, okay, what about that do I want to hold on to? And what do I not want to raise my daughter with?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so looking at your story, and yeah, just to give people who haven't read the book yet highlights, I mean, we say you went through everything from, yeah, the eating disorder and anorexia and rape and cancer and, modeling and promiscuity to at least to a fairly conservative point of view.
Oh, no. You can just call it what it was.
Okay. Okay. So you did a lot of things. And again, from a Christian standpoint, you know, you made it even one of the topics of your chapters there that you model for Playboy. I thought, man, that's going to be uncomfortable for some folks. But, you know, Zig used to get up and on stage, the very first part of most of his talks was telling about his childhood. I was 5 years old, you know, this many kids, dad died, I had to go to work, yada, yada. And he did that so that people could relate to him and they would not discount him. And that's what I saw shining from your story. Yeah, especially your first one where you're standing up looking all trim and perfect and beautiful in front of these addicts. And you said, you're judging me. And then you told the story and boom. And I love that fruition that 2 years now you're working with them and intimate with them. And I just want people to hear that. Even myself, I'm not as a personality that speaks to a lot of people. My story has just not usually been that relevant, especially because it doesn't seem that wowsome. I didn't go through trauma. I didn't have some, you know, horrendous thing to tell about. But I'd come out with things and people go, tell me more about that. You were a professional cyclist. Tell me about that. I did something with, I was with Tom Ziegler recently and just mentioned a story. I said, man, I never knew that about you. And I forget to tell the story to give people context because I know we also have folks that are burned because they feel like we've got the narcissistic, you know, personalities over here. And it's all they do is talk about themselves. But yours, it's got to have allowed who can't relate to you to some degree.
You know, what's interesting is you just said something. You're like, you know, I don't have that much to talk to people about like this because I didn't go through trauma and I've lived a privileged life. My daughter would tell you the same thing. She sure. often says to me, I don't get what you're talking about. Cause I've got eyes in the back of my head. I've got this spidey sense. Right. So it's like, we'll be walking somewhere and I'm like, Chloe, pay attention, look behind you. Like, wow. I'm one of those people. Right. I mean, even where we live, where it's a nice neighborhood, like I'm got cameras everywhere.
I think you've earned that. Yeah.
Right. And so she's like, Mom, I just can't relate. I can't relate to you. She's like, I had an amazing life and I'm sorry you went through that, but I can't relate. And I looked at her and I said, you know, honey, never apologize for not being traumatized. I mean, you know, don't apologize for that. You've got your own story. You've got your own journey. You have your own gifts that you're going to bring to the world, but never apologize for not being traumatized.
Okay. So I want to dig in here on, we can call it trauma, but hardship, challenge, whatever. So again, one of a talk that Zig often put into his messages was a study that was done a long time ago where they took world leaders and influencers, did a study on them and found that it was 80% some that the vast majority came from poverty, handicap, brothers and sisters that were handicapped, something that gave them a significant hardship. And it's a great story that they, you know, overcame that. It gave them strength to do what they do. And now these are the people who are leading us. And yet he doesn't talk about, and I've pondered it with other people before as well, that for every one of those people who had all these things happen to me, and I'll put it to you. So for all the other women or, you know, people who had a similar lifestyle of yours, of hardship, that for every one of you, I've got to assume there's, I don't know, I could make the statistic up, 100 others, 1,000, 10,000, that it overcame. And we right. always then wonder what it is that allowed you, or I'll put it to you, the quality that you, if you look back, what would you say? What's the quality that allowed you to overcome, to let it strengthen you instead of being overcome by it?
So I touched on it earlier. It's grit.
Okay.
It's grit. It's resilience. It's my mom gave that to me. My dad did not have that. So it's interesting, but I will say this. I wanted to say this. So Zig Ziglar actually has a special place in my heart. My dad, who I was not close to because it's a bad relationship. Yeah. And I write about that. I have daddy issues. It's all in my book.
Yeah.
But he tried to come into my life at one point, but he had never been there in the past. So I wasn't listening. showed up in my life at a time when things were really bad and tried to give me a book of Zig Ziglar's. And I'm like, why would I listen to anything you have to say? Like, you've never been present for me. So I didn't really take it in.
Yeah.
But a few years later, when I was ready, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. All of a sudden, I'm like, what is this book? And I started reading it and I'm like, oh, this stuff makes sense. Like, this really makes sense. But I was ready to hear the message then.
Was it See You at the Top?
What's that? Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And so I had to be ready to hear the message. And right. It really doesn't matter who's delivering the message. I was discounting Zig Ziglar's book because of who delivered it, which is, to anybody listening, don't do that.
Yeah.
So someone, you know, messages come from all sorts of places. Pay attention to the message, not always the messenger. So it was really interesting, though, that that's where that book came from. And it was a really powerful book.
Yeah.
Even I was young and it was a very powerful book.
It is. You know, on that, though, on that aspect, would you say, looking back, we talk so often, she comes up in so many conversations, Carol Dweck, with her book, you know, Mindset, and that growth or fix, that if you have somebody go through what you did, that for whatever reason that you maybe can't take credit for and don't know why, maybe because of your mom, she did give you a growth mindset. So even through that trauma, I mean, I wonder if we can boil so much back just to that.
So my husband and I talk a lot about post-traumatic growth versus post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
You always have a percentage of people who go through trauma who are going to experience post-traumatic stress disorder. It's going to cripple them.
Yeah.
But there's a small percentage of people who end up growing stress. It's like, how do you forge steel, right? You put it in fire and that makes them stronger. And there just is. And they're doing a lot of studies on this, but I do believe at least part of it is modeled for you. Now, my mom just would not take no for an answer. This is a woman who, yeah, she made a lot of bad decisions, but she just would not let things get her down. So no matter how bad things got, and even with all the bad decisions, she fought through it. And that's the one thing I can always remember. And I think that's part of why I'm still close to her. Do I think she made bad decisions? Yeah, I made the choice not to make those same bad decisions. But I can always remember going, you know, the woman, she's like the Tasmanian devil combined with Lucille Ball. She's a little crazy. But she just isn't going to let anyone define her or tell her how it's going to be just because she doesn't have a high school diploma.
Yeah.
Just because she, you know, whatever it is, she's a female during a time when women can't make it. It didn't matter. And so that's the thing I took away from that.
Yeah, it is. You do showcase that she did not let anything limit her. And you have done the same. You know, talking about that book that your dad gave you, See You at the Top, that you weren't ready for at the time. In the book, and I didn't put down the page number, but midway through, you tell about really a catalyst for your life change, really a flip-flop, a 180, when Uncle Bob in your life took you to a seminar, and between his sharing with you and the seminar, you ultimately realized the ability to control yourself, and you made the statement of you realized how much of your control you had given away, and you made a radical change. It seems like from that standpoint, and honestly, I felt like I wanted more because it was like three pages, and man, life change. And then you go forward from there. And I'm like, seriously, that's the catalyst. Back to Donald Miller. This was in his book that I've given scores of away, A Million Miles in 1,000 Years. And he talks about that inciting incident. What is it that in every great story, you have that inciting incident that changes thing, that the mediocre person becomes the hero, that they rise up to the challenge or whatnot in that. And to me, I thought, I mean, there's an inciting incident there. And maybe to you, there wasn't any specific thing that made you ready. Well, but that made you ready for it. I mean, why did that come at that point? And boom, you took it. And not that everything was perfect from that point on, and it was a perfect trajectory up. But that way, I mean, in the book, it's halfway point and you go forward from there. And again, I want to look at that and go, what was it that allowed you to be open, that allowed a person to be open to finally take something and go, I'm ready, I'm aware, I'm going to go a different direction?
So quite honestly, it's because I hit rock bottom, and then my rock bottom had a basement and then a sub basement. Okay. I was just so low.
Okay.
And I'd made such a mess of my life. And, you know, whatever trauma I experienced as a child, in my 20s, it was more a series of bad decisions. Okay. So it was pretty much self-induced, and it was my fault. I mean, let's just own it. So many of us, you know, we end up where we end up because of other people. But then at certain points, if we're honest with ourselves, it's because we made bad decisions. Just is what it is. And the sooner you admit that, the easier it is to turn it around.
Yeah.
And I had made this series of bad decisions. And quite honestly, you talked earlier about being promiscuous. And, you know, part of that came from being so broken. And I thought that after being going through sexual trauma, it's like I had this thought, men play so many games. And the only way for me to survive this game is to be better at it than they are. And so there's this disconnecting, there's this coldness that happens. And it's a terrible place to be because it affects all of your relationships. It doesn't just affect your relationships with men. It affects all of your relationships. But I was becoming the thing I hated. And so after this series of bad decisions, you know, all of a sudden the one person who I didn't like very much when I was growing up, because he was a heroin addict, because he got my other uncle murdered, because so many things, all the chaos that was in our house. Yeah. But he had turned his life around. He had taken responsibility. And he shows up and there's this full circle moment where he's teaching these self-help seminars, my Uncle Bob. And he's like, hey, you know, why don't you come out here and, you know, come to Hawaii for a couple weeks and I'm teaching these seminars. It might be good for you. And I'm thinking there's no self-help seminar that's going to help me. But a trip to Hawaii would be good right now. So I was in it for Hawaii. But the seminar was great, but it was really the conversation I had with Bob. And I should have known. I mean, he's been through so much on his own to overcome what he overcame. He was a wealth of wisdom. But we had this one conversation and it was all about responsibility. And he drew a circle on a piece of paper and he split it in half. And he said, you know, how much responsibility are you willing to take for your life? And I'm like, for cancer? For being molested? For which part? Which part do you think I'm responsible for? And he looked at me and he said, I didn't ask you how much blame you were willing to take, because it's not your fault. That's not what I said. I asked you how much responsibility you're willing to take for where you're at now. Responsibility means the ability to respond. And bam, it was like this light switch moment. I was like, what? Like, it doesn't mean blame. It means response. I get to respond. And he looked at that circle that was split in half. And he said, if you take 50%, then someone else, you have 50% control, but someone else or something else still has 50% control over the outcome. And I was like, no, heck no. I don't want anyone else to have control over the outcome.
Yeah.
Like at that point I wanted 100%, and it was a light switch moment and it changed the trajectory of my life.
Okay. Well, let's go there then, the trajectory, because yeah, if this is a movie story here, this isn't that the next day you are at success. And you talked about a couple times going into therapy, and you specifically wrote about EMDR, which I'll tell you, I'm familiar with. I've heard great testimony. I've considered doing it to understand that, but you went into that, and not to make this the point of that tool in and of itself, but share a little bit about what that did to help you understand more, get clarity more, so that you could have more control.
So EMDR is amazing because it's a specific type of therapy. It's eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. It's specific to trauma. And when I first started, I mean, I was not a girl. I was a hard charging ICU nurse. Don't want to hear walkie talkies. Don't want to hear psychobabble. Intubated, sedated, let's not talk about our problems. Don't want to deal with this. But I finally decided it was time through a series, you know, basically when I met my husband, and I wasn't a patient, we were dating, but he just was so patient and loving and he just kept encouraging this. And his first gift to me was 10 sessions of EMDR. I'm like, all right, fine. I'm going to go try this. Probably not going to do this, but we'll try one or two sessions. And I realized it was different. It really does help you reprocess it. It's super interesting. And it helps you to reprocess it as an adult. So the trauma that we experience when we're young, we have certain strategies when you're four, right, that you use to survive. But those same strategies that we hold on to, because we've never learned a different strategy, are not the strategies that are going to help you when you're 40.
Okay.
So we learn these new strategies in therapy, and you go back and reprocess this as an adult, and you're able to sort of let it go. And so it was just so powerful. It was so interesting to be able to do that. And they've done studies using EMDR with officers, police officers who have been in officer involved shootings. And it's like miraculous. It's amazing how well it works.
Well, another thing you hit on, I mean, there's so much that happened in your childhood. I have been interested. So we got involved in telomeres. with one of the companies and ended up talking to their chief medical officer because we did it amongst ourselves and staff. And we're really surprised at some of the people who had these great telomere scores and some others who had these horrific ones. And we're looking at them going, I don't know how much of a healthier life you can live. And I was disappointed. And so again, we talked to the chief medical officer and he said, you know, it's still an emerging science. It's not a perfected thing at this point. But one of the things that he talked about that they're seeing that has a really statistically has a really big play in the health of your telomeres, which layman's terms for folks, what can we say, your chromosome health, is ACE scores, adverse childhood, you know, effects, which I would have to think, and again, this, I'm not a professional medical provider here, but I would have to think that your ACE scores are not real well,
not good.
And in the light of their everything, well, can you change that? Can you reverse ACE scores if and I don't want to make this about chromosomes, but if it has that much of an impact on somebody's health, obviously, you know, you're living the redemption, you know, of that. But again, going to people who are concerned with, you know, how much can I really recover, Tana?
So this is all based on the work I did prior to this book. So the Omni Diet Brain Warriors Way, I love metaphors because I just think they're powerful and they're helpful at times when we're not strong. I adopted the metaphor of being a warrior a long time ago. That's why I practice martial arts. I've got a second degree black belt in Kenpo and a black belt in Taekwondo. Not because I'm so tough, because I just kept showing up, right? You show up long enough, they're going to put a belt on you eventually. But it was a metaphor for me when I was weak. It was a metaphor when I was down. That it's like, what is the opposite of me right now? How do I behave differently than I am? And I gathered how to do that through books like See You at the Top or through Tony Robbins or all these different people. It's like, how do I change my physical state so that I now start to adopt this as my lifestyle? And so I adopted this metaphor as being a warrior. And I thought, who's the opposite of me? Warriors. They show up armed, prepared, aware. They're tough. They fight even when they don't want to, when they're hurt, when they're sick. I mean, these are people that get the job done and they protect us. And so I started practicing martial arts. It's a whole thing for me. But what you talked about with the telomeres is really interesting because, yeah, you can't change what happened to you in the past, but you can change how you're still seeing it. You can change the fact that you're still dwelling on it. And I love this saying, someone did something to you once, twice, maybe even 10 times, but who is more cruel? The person who hurt you in the past or you for replaying it 1,000 times over and over and over. And I know that sounds harsh, but I'm doing that for a reason, because if you continue to replay that, every time you replay that, your brain does not have a sense of humor. It just does what you tell it to do. It doesn't really understand the difference between your past trauma and what you continue to keep replaying. Right. So you get it under control, because that is how you now begin to fight that with your telomeres. I'm drinking my green tea. I take my supplements. I do all these things, but you got to get that past trauma reprocessed.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. We've used that word trauma, which honestly, you don't use that a ton in the book, but
I hate the word.
Okay. Well, but it's interesting. I mean, you went from part of your trajectory from this inciting incident was going to nursing school and you became a trauma nurse.
Weird, right?
Well, but again, the interest, I appreciate that as people are hearing this and they're still seeking the direction that they want to go, that you did go into an area that you obviously not only had experience in, but had a heart for. I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah. The type of trauma, though, that I was dealing with, I actually couldn't handle dealing with. My professors wanted me to go into psych nursing, and I couldn't stand psych nursing. I literally couldn't stand it because I'm sure it had to do with my own issues. And now I'm married to a psychiatrist. Go figure.
I noticed that.
But I remember her saying, you are so good at this and you have so much insight. I'm like, there's no way I'm dealing with people's past stuff like all day long. I'm just not doing it. And I'm sure that's because I hadn't dealt with my own. But when I went into nursing, I chose a level A trauma unit where it's blood, guts, gunshot wounds, like that I could deal with. I just couldn't deal with people talking about their problems all day long. There was no way that was going to happen. I wasn't ready for it. And now here I am married to a psychiatrist and I love what I do. So it's interesting that you actually brought that up, because I was very clear they need to be sedated and intubated and not talking. So.
Yeah, that's fair. You had a quote somewhere. I read it in some of your stuff or online somewhere, and I actually wrote it out and then came to find that it was in the latter part of your book. And it's actually from your husband, Daniel. And you cited it again in the back of the book that it's easy to call people bad and harder to ask why. Mm-hmm. That's a significant statement. And when you come back to your story of being in front of the addicts and originally you were judging them, that's a word, Tana, that I have been talking about more and more and more in the past, probably the past year, with the racial things that we've had. And I've had some really in-depth talks with family members on faith, and that judgment seems to come to the front of all these conflicts that we have. It's the right or wrong, the good or bad, and it's judgment. And especially from a Christian standpoint, I think we've been some of the worst perpetrators of that word and making it so volatile for people. So back to that statement, it's easy to call people bad and harder to ask why and understand. And it feels like that's a lot of the cry of your heart in this book.
So it's so interesting you bring that up. My husband has a book coming out at the same time, like just coming out. We're doing our PBS show together. His book is called Your Brain is Always Listening. And it's about the dragons from the past that breathe fire on your emotional brain. We just today did, some media around the judgmental dragon, which is one of my top ones, the judgmental dragon. But where that comes from is if people really step back and understand why does this judgmental dragon breathe fire on my brain? Most of us who have gone through significant chaos in the past where things felt unsafe, or they were unsafe, or you were hurt, or there was injustice, you witnessed injustice, we can tend to latch on to judgment because it keeps us safe. Mm-hmm. We need things black and white. So if you understand why you're doing it, it makes it easier then to go, okay, am I focused on the past right now, or am I actually focused on the problem at present? Because I can get wound up really quick. Mm-hmm. You talk about hurting my child, I'm going to go crazy, right? Because that's my past haunting my present. So that judgmental dragon is keeping the rules in place that keep my life safe. And so understanding it from a psychological perspective is really helpful. Because my husband will joke. He's like, I feel like I live with the judge, the jury, and the executioner. Wow. So also part of it is forgiveness. And forgiveness for me is a daily practice. People will often say, how did you forgive the people in your life? Well, number one, it's because I went through and actually did a thorough accounting, because your memories are always valid, but they're not always accurate. Mm. If you're talking about memories of a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old, you're seeing it through a child's eyes. So going back and doing a thorough adult's accounting of it is, and interviewing the people is really important. But then also being able to process that now and move forward. So this need to judge the past and being able to forgive the people in your past, forgiveness is important because it hurts you.
Yeah.
It hurts. Most of those people don't care. They don't know. They don't care. They're moved on with their life. So if you can let that go, it's powerful. It's important for you moving on, for you to have a healthy life, especially a spiritual life. But it's a daily practice, because there are some people you're going to have a hard time letting go of. You're going to have a hard time letting go of what happened, because it wasn't just. It wasn't fair. Life isn't fair. No one ever told you life was going to be fair.
Yeah.
But a daily practice of like letting that anger go, letting that judgment go, and realizing that it hurts you more than it hurts anyone. And it hurts the people around you.
Well, I appreciate you said it in a couple different ways of how we tend to, you talked about it with EMDR, that we, have an experience and we coped with it as we could as a child. And sometimes we're trying to use those same coping mechanisms as adults. And now you just again said that almost kind of the call to do an audit of our memories, that our perspective changes. In essence, I'll paraphrase, our perspective changes. I've been really overwhelmed with that the reality of, the memory that I had of that thing that happened at this age, and I had a perspective on it, and that perspective 5 years later changed. And now the perspective 40 years later has changed. And what's the truth of the memory? My goodness, it puts it up for grabs as to what the reality was.
Just your perspective. There were other people there Absolutely. Who have different perspectives. So you got to put them all together.
Absolutely. You know, you talked about having at the start of the show, in essence, two audiences that you think of with this. But I'm going to ask in a different way. We talk about purpose. Everybody listening to this show is desiring to pursue their purpose, to clarify their purpose. And to do that, we use the word passion a lot, you know, to know what is it that you're passionate about. And I have spoken it probably a couple dozen times now since a couple shows with John O'Leary and then Sam Collier, two guys I had on interviews in about a 2-week span of time. And they both, in talking about this issue of purpose and passion, they both, you know, separately talked about what is that thing that breaks your heart. And so when I think about you, as you wrote this book with probably your heart broken for yourself to some degree still, I mean, how can you not to look back at the person you were, that kid that you were, but who is it that as you're writing it and hoping gets this, that your heart breaks for?
I have a special place in my heart for children. So we've adopted our nieces. We're their legal guardians now. Obviously they're part of my family. So the story is, it's pretty obvious why. But children who go through, traumatic events, who grow up in chaos, that's where I feel like we need to really focus our energy because we need to change the next generation. I know there are adults in my family that are not going to change. They just don't, they're not there. They don't want to, or they want to, and they just can't.
Yeah.
But if we can focus on the children, that's the next generation. And I really hope that people who haven't let the past go, who are having trouble with forgiveness, who are having trouble with releasing the shame, that's really important. But also knowing that, like, if we can focus not just on ourselves, but that next generation, we have a responsibility to the next generation.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having the courage to do this. And I feel like it's going to give permission to a lot of people, me included, all of us, permission to be forthright with our stories, maybe with ourselves to begin with, but then also question whether we should let it be a part of our story to other people so that we can relate, they can relate, and we can come together. But such a courageous book. Thanks for giving us your time and sharing your heart here.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin.
Friends, I know there are many stories of hard pasts redeemed to great success, but this one speaks to those who have maybe kept their past hidden or undealt with and are missing out on the power and redemption that can be had by getting it out. And for some of you leading others, you may very well have gotten some light on how you can use your story for your own and others' greater benefit. I really encourage you, you can get more from Tana. Check out her book, The Relentless Courage of a Scared Child, anywhere you buy books, but you can also find it and more at her website, relentlesscourage.com. Coming up in episode 866 of The Ziegler Show, I asked our listeners, what limiting conditioning have you overcome? Tom Ziegler and I talked through many of the comments, which were more varied than I expected, as they often are. Really interesting to hear. And I found myself days later talking to my kids about the concept and exposing the reality that we all let conditioning minimize us and how simply becoming aware is such a powerful freedom and a release to greater progress and possibility in our lives. Till then, folks, thank you as always for letting me walk with you as we inspire our true performance together.